Mr. Garland, good morning to you.
Justice Hennigan, thank you, sir. Associate Justices, thank you. If it pleases the court, I'm down here to argue the point about whether Daubert applies to 702 opinions on standard of care. And the reason it's important to my client is because if it does not apply, then my opponent wins. And if it does apply, then I think I win, and I think I win without a trial. Because at the 104 motion to exclude, the defense presented zero evidence that showed anybody had done any type of reasoning or used any methodology to arrive at their conclusions that someone met the standard of care. And essentially what they did was went down and argued it was a fact versus an opinion. It is our position that when a 702 is called to the stand and asked questions about elements, he's giving you an opinion. And when someone says, well, the standard of care is established and it's a fact, well, according to them, maybe it does, but we have someone who says it's not. So if you have two people disagreeing about a fact, so to speak, and they're both professionals and they're experts, they're qualified by 702 and they're given the scientific or technical data, then that's an opinion. And if it's an opinion, then we've got to have the Schaeffersman rigor. And while they argue that maybe methodologies don't apply, like the differential or the differential etiology, certainly criteria goes into the selection of what a standard of care is. And to just allow someone to make the circular argument of the standard of care is what it is because that's what people do, and it's that's what people do is because it's the standard of care, leaves out the backstory or the reasoning as to why they do it.
So what do you mean by methodology here? What would be necessary under your theory to qualify these folks as experts?
Oh, okay, I'm going to concede they're qualified as experts, and I'm going to concede that the methodology word probably doesn't work with standard of care, but there are certainly very specific criteria that go into determining what a standard is.
And what would those be? What would that criteria be?
Very simply, effectiveness of treatment, patient safety, and cost, C-O-S-T. The record says C-A-U-S-E-D, but the word I meant to say was cost. You can ask your own doctor, you can ask any doctor. We ask them all the time. Those are the only three criteria that go into forming a standard of care. And in America, cost is so far down the line, it really is irrelevant. So what you're talking about is when someone says the standard of care in a case is to do X, well, either it's got to be more effective or it's safer for the patient. And when there's two choices, those are the criteria. I'm asking a lot here. And just to allow someone to come in, an expert, and say this is what the standard of care is essentially an ipsy-dixit opinion that takes us back to pre-Daubert days where an expert can come in and say, I'm brilliant, I've memorized the facts, and this is what I think. Well, Garland has zero chance of cross-examining that witness and making any headway. But if I can get him to say, well, tell me what the criteria is. Well, it's safer, it's more effective. Now I've got something to talk with
him. Can't you ask him those things?
I could, but they didn't give me any of that information at the 104 hearing, so they
couldn't
don't.
Couldn't you ask it in a deposition?
I didn't take a deposition, and there was a specific reason for that, Your Honor. It's $5,000 to take a deposition. I need to know that stuff in advance.
Could you ask it in an interrogatory?
I did.
And what was your answer?
I don't have to give it to you. It's not required by Nebraska law. That's what they said.
Counselor, did you call their expert as a live witness at the motion in limine?
I did not.
Okay. And you didn't take his deposition, so was there a deposition to even offer at the motion in limine as to their expert?
No.
Okay. Wouldn't the burden of proof at the motion in limine been on you?
Or would you what?
To go forward. The moving party always has the burden when they file a motion, correct?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. If you didn't offer any evidence as to what their expert would testify or not testify to, how would the judge have enough evidence at the motion limiting hearing to make a decision?
So now are you saying it's my responsibility to offer evidence on behalf of the opposing party?
I'm saying that our law has consistently always been the moving party has the burden on any motion, don't they?
Yes, but in Schaeffersman, what it says is once I challenge them, their expert on the 104, they have to present the evidence. And one of the things I want to be clear about here is this isn't a discovery question. This is a motion question, evidentiary question. I presented a 104 to admit they were not, he was not challenged. My man is in on all the elements. But when they offer theirs, I challenge theirs on a 104 to exclude. I want to know the thinking. And the judge took the position that it's my responsibility to deliver evidence to him so he can make a consideration. From an advocacy standpoint, that makes no sense. Now I have to go tell my client that the law in the state is that even though they want to basically give me the legal finger and say they don't have to give it to me, I now have to go do it?
Did you move to compel?
No.
Why not?
Because I was perfectly happy with their position. They took a position that is untenable.
Then why wouldn't you have won on a motion to compel and gotten the information that you needed?
Because I would, well, all right, from an advocacy position, they made a strategic decision not to deliver that information when asked appropriately in an interrogatory, and asked a second time. So when it comes to the evidentiary hearing, why is it my responsibility to produce that evidence? These are sharp lawyers. They know what they have to do. They can read Schaefer's, but we all read Daubert. So basically what you're saying here, if that's the case, Justice Spacey, what's going to happen is now you're going to put the burden on the opposed, on the moving party to now present evidence on behalf of an opposing party. What's their job? Don't they have to do that?
Have we spoken to that
in
any of our cases?
No. But in Schaefer's, when you said you got to focus on the process, you got to focus on the reasoning, where's the reasoning in the opinion that, you know, I read it, I'm a brilliant doctor, and I memorized all the facts, and here's my opinion. How does that provide us anything? And from a procedural standpoint, I think it's a bad...
Does Zimmerman help you at all?
Zimmerman helps me a lot. All of them help me. Essentially, you take Zimmerman and Carlson and anything else that's happened after Schaefer's, when they're basically saying the same thing. The court's got to focus on the reasoning. It's not my job to present their evidence. If I was at that point, here's what I was thinking. They have told me basically to stick it. I'm not telling you what it is. And so when it comes to when I file the motion, a 104 to exclude, all I had to do was just show up with it that day. Now I could have complained about I got cheated because I didn't get that in advance, but that wouldn't have made any difference to me. All I wanted him to do was say, work through this and it's safer and it's more effective. If they'd have done that, we're not here.
Assuming you're right. What about harmless error?
I disagree with that because on a 104 to exclude, the moment that the evidence would have been excluded, and remember, my man is already in, so he's going to be testifying on all the elements. So here, when they don't, if it's excluded, well, guess what's circled behind it? Expert cutoff date, discovery cutoff date. Next, the moment that he comes down with his ruling that says I'm excluding, guess what? I'm filing a motion for summary judgment. They got nothing. Zero. And we win automatically. And at that point, we don't have to talk about Garland's trial screw up because I shouldn't have been in trial. So this is a very big and broad question. Expert testimony is everywhere. And you're going to see it more and more. PI lawyers are going to find out very soon that subsequent treating physicians who come in and try to say things about what their opinions and diagnoses are going to get slammed because they didn't disclose them. They call them fact witnesses, but just like under 8035A, once a doctor starts talking about his opinions and diagnoses, he's entered the world of 702. And so at that point, we need to have some very clear lines here because this is going to keep coming up over and over and over again. I reserve the rest of my time.
Let me ask you one real quick one. You were saying we've got very clear lines, and it can be the case that we can have somebody who's both a fact witness and an expert scientifically.
Yes, but the moment they tell you what they think, now they've entered the world of 702. A fact is the doctor attended, the witness attended a university, he did this, he's read the records, those are facts. But when he comes into court and tells you what he thinks, that's it.
Can training and experience qualify to meet the Daubert standards?
Only 20% of it. You got to have qualifications, which is the education, training, and experience. You got to know the facts. And that's what we used to do back in the Fry world. But now, in the Daubert world, we've got to also talk about the methodologies. We've got to talk about the reasoning. We've got to talk about the appropriate application there to the facts. And we've got to reach a logical conclusion. We just can't work through everything and say the moon is made of cheese. And that was the purpose of Daubert. Judge Girard said it really, really good many, many years ago, and I hate to see us go away from it. And I think it applies to every single opinion which includes standard of care, which is the basis of the truth. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Black, good morning to you.
Good morning. I am here today representing the appellees. Where I'd like to begin is I think that the argument from appellant's counsel has shortchanged what the judge did and what the judge had in front of him when he looked at this particular
matter. Didn't the judge say Daubert doesn't apply here?
Yeah, and he says, well, what he actually says is when you read the whole thing, and one benefit of being appellate counsel, I'm the same place as you, I get to read the record cold. He said, I don't think it's, he eventually said Daubert applies, but there's no exception to Daubert, so it applies, but it doesn't apply here. And I think what he was going back to, and you read that in his entirety, is he was saying, I have here an established methodology for determining the standard of care. And Mr. Garland admitted it was an accepted methodology. I don't need to go into that part of Daubert that looks at a novel question and that analysis of facts. I think it points to the fact that with Daubert, we've kind of got to the point where we saw those facts and those factors, and we became so enamored with them, we thought they applied to every type of case. It's the tendency of having a really good hammer, a lot of things look like they need to be hit. But with this particular question, those factors don't apply. Experience, and I think what you were getting at, and I think it's a syllabus point, application of experience to the facts can be an acceptable methodology under Daubert and Schaeferson. And that's what we had here. And it's especially important here because of the issue we're looking at, the standard of care. Standard of care is statutorily defined. This court has said it's the customary practice among ordinary and prudent physicians. What a physician said, and this court has said this clearly too, doesn't mean a hill of beans. What a physician would do or what they would say is wrong doesn't establish the standard of care. As you look at it, it's almost a survey result. And then you look at how are you going to get testimony, how is a plaintiff going to produce that testimony if we're not looking at people who are educated in the field to look around and say, what are people in my field doing in these sets of circumstances?
Counsel,
that's the standard of care.
Who has the burden in a motion of limine to put the evidence on for this?
As I read through the cases, I think it's somewhat unclear. It is certainly the burden of going forward of the moving party. At that particular point, I think some showing has to be made by the proponent of the witnesses. Here it was done because the designation of expert witnesses was before the court. So with that was done. The other complicating issue, of course, is that the judge's ruling at that hearing doesn't preserve error because we're very clear that a ruling on a motion for limine does not come here. We don't get to that particular point until the objection is made at trial, and that's where we have error that can be assigned to this court for reversible error. So
counsel,
then we have more record in front of the judge when he's reaffirming that ruling.
Counsel, do you think the something that says designation of expert, which is signed by the attorney, is the same as an affidavit or deposition?
I think it binds because if you get on the other side of that, the judge is going to say, I've got this designation. In this designation, the witness didn't say he was going to say X. I'm not going to let him or her testify. So I think it's a binding document. Is it evidentiary in the same sense? I don't think we could ever say that. But I think it's a binding document that sets forth. And then again, I get back to the point, when we get to where we have reversible error, of course we have the record of the experts testifying at trial, which sets up why that's their opinion. The other thing we can't forget is at this stage, it's a gatekeeping rule. Have they met that minimum standard so we turn it over to the jury under cross-examination?
Isn't that burden is on you to show the judge that that has been done?
I think that burden would be there. Here, what the unique circumstance we have is we have counsel admitting that the methodology they're implying is the accepted methodology. And under the examination by the judge asked Mr. Garland, how do experts determine standard of care? And he says they do it exactly like you think it would be, training, education, experience. Then he goes on to say, but I think I want more. And I think that's kind of the undercurrent danger in this particular case.
He talked about effectiveness of treatment and safety to the patients. Did you do any of that, and is that required?
The designation, as I recall, did not refer to those issues. That comes into play not with regard to a physician's testimony, but with regard to that ordinary and prudent physician. What are the other physicians out there doing given this information? How has this evolved? The example I like to look back at standard of care is George Washington died while undergoing a bloodletting. At the time, the standard of care. No longer. It didn't have a court change that. What changed that was evolution in science.
Mr. Garland says that he asked you in an interrogatory, or asked defense counsel in an interrogatory, to answer questions that went to the criteria underlying the opinion, and that that question, that that interrogatory was not answered. Why?
You're correct in that I wasn't trial counsel, and I haven't seen the discovery because I don't believe it's
in the record. Record?
I don't believe it is. I have not seen it. What Judge Gleason said when that was brought up is if you would have filed a motion to compel, he said, I'm not going to answer hypotheticals, but if you would have filed a motion to compel, I would have required that they answer that. Hypothetically, he said. So I don't know what the actual answer says. I really can't speak to it. I'm sorry, but as appellate counsel, I'm just looking at what the record was, and that was brought up at the hearing, but I don't think that the discovery's in there. I don't recall that it is. And where I was going is I think where we have an accepted methodology that experts are applying, that we're now pushing Schaefer to one another, desiring to do something else. The danger before is we have somebody come in and say, I have a suit, I've been to a seminar, I'm an expert, I can tell you what I think. With Schaeferman, we got to the point where we said, no, you have to do inside the courtroom the same thing you do outside the courtroom. The word that's used is rigor. Maybe the only place I ever see the word rigor used is with regard to this. You must have the same rigor in the courtroom as you do outside the courtroom. In this particular case, it's admitted that the methodology used outside the courtroom was used inside the courtroom. So in essence, what they're asking this court to do, and lower courts on their gatekeeping, is say, no, you have to go farther and require of experts here what they don't do out there. And I don't think that's the road you want to go down.
Does the Stetson case help us at all?
I'm not familiar with that one. Okay. I'm sorry, I just don't recognize that one off the top of my head. But I do recognize, oddly enough, when I started looking into this, there's not a lot of appellate opinions on this particular issue.
Why is that?
I think because it's fairly well recognized that training, education, and experience is how you get there. In fact, one of the ironies of this case is that when plaintiff is talking about the locality rule, my wife and my expert practices in Philadelphia, testify in Omaha, he says, well, the standard of care is the same. Why is it the same? Well, we all have the same education in school. We all go to the same seminars, training. I've observed a lot of operations, experience. So training, education, and experience can tell you the standard of care is the same in Philadelphia as it is in Omaha, but it can't tell you what it is. And I think that that just doesn't make any sense.
So what is the rule that this court should come down with in regard to Daubert and standard of care?
I think because it's a gatekeeping role and ultimately it says flexibility, that you just have to embody that. The reason I say that is that the analysis was, what would an engineer say in her experience is the reason the bridge fell is going to look different than a pastry chef saying why the souffle fell. In that experience, in that analysis, is different as to what the expert does out there in the real world. And so what you're looking at is, does that expert use the same methodology out there as he or she wants to use in here? And so you have to allow the judge's flexibility at the trial stage to make those determinations. Because we have almost, I think, an infinite variety of experts that we could have given the issues.
Are we going too far? Is this an expert event?
I don't understand the question. Mm-hmm. May I answer the question?
You may.
Is the, just backtracking altogether, is the Daubert rigor applicable to standard of care witnesses?
I think it's applicable from a standpoint, are you doing the same methodology that you would do to determine that out there? You're looking at a doctor saying, okay, I've got this situation. How am I going to treat it? What's the standard of care? They rely on training, education, and experience to make that determination. So in that, I think it perfectly applies inside and out. No further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case.